Now, what is doubt? Doubt is something that draws you back to your old ways of dealing with pain and stress. Doubt can be paralyzing. Doubt is a way to bring you back to the pushing the pain inside approach to stress. Doubt can draw you back to handling stress by shoving it inside. You must fight through the doubt. Now, start out by using your rational brain. Make lists of reasons why you believe the condition is TMS and any concerns you have as to why it might not be. Step back, look through those reasons, see if you can convince yourself that you're comfortable with the diagnosis. But also use your emotional brain. Connect to the feelings that this diagnosis evokes and what connected you to this approach in the first place. Why this led you to accept that this approach would be something that could help you.
Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. It is Wednesday, September the 19th. Thanks so much for tuning in today. As always, the number one thing that you can do to support this show is to head on over to Apple Podcasts or iTunes and leave a review, a five-star review if you really, really like what you hear. Tap, write a review. It really, really helps the show get more exposure, reach more people, help more people. Messages are really starting to come in quite a bit, actually. People saying that this podcast has been helping them tremendously in their path to healing, and I'm going to get into more of that here in a couple of minutes. I also wanted to touch base on a couple of things. So, and by the way, if you want to get in touch with the show or be involved in the show more interactive, and I'll link both of these in the description or in the show notes today, but head on over to the Facebook page, give it a like, and then there's also a Facebook group that I have created that is very, very young as well. There's about 20 members in there right now. I run polls. I talk about show concepts. It's going to be kind of a place of a mastermind group. Different people that like the show, enjoy the show, get some value out of the show. It's where I'm going to want to get some of your input. So we'll go ahead and we'll start with that. You know, in the last couple of episodes, one of the things that I threw out there to the world is this concept of doing some kind of a coaching program, a one-on-one design, perhaps group coaching. I'm really kind of settling on what the model and what the design that I want of it is. But for people that feel like they're stuck in healing, and I had said if you feel like you're stuck and you want some more guidance, perhaps some kind of a coaching environment, shoot me over a DM. And there's actually been more messages than I anticipated. And over the next few days, which is a good thing, over the next few days, I've got some introductory calls with multiple people to talk about kind of where they're stuck, where they feel like they're stuck. I feel like I've really studied this stuff so much over the last year and a half. And then all the books, all the publications, all the studies, all the interviews, all of this, and I've obviously dedicated a ton of free content to people that are in this TMS mind-body space with this podcast over the last year or so, that I want to see what else I can do to be of service to the world. So there's three different things I'm looking at. DM me if you have any suggestions. But I'm thinking of maybe one track where it's like an e-course type of a model. I'm thinking of another one where maybe it's a little bit more of a group coaching environment where you can get grouped up with a few people. And then another one where it's just one-on-one if you really are kind of at the wit's end, if you will. I think that a lot of people read the books in the space and they sort of get stuck. They wonder, what is it that I can do now? And if you are that person, if you feel like you're at that point, I think that I could be a great resource for you. There's quite a few steps that I think can be involved, and I don't think it has to be an overly long journey, but I do think that I can help you. So we'll stick to that. I'd love to hear from you. Go ahead and feel free to send me a message either on Instagram, Facebook, even on LinkedIn. You can find me. So we'll split off from that for a moment. I want to talk about something too, and I would love some people's input on this too, if you care to share. So my wife, she comes up to me last week, and she corrected me. I was talking about setting yourself up for the worst, basically, and I talked about going to get vaccines with our kids, and that she kind of prepares our 4-year-old for the worst. Perhaps I misspoke. Really, it's just preparing Zoe and sort of letting her know that something's going to happen, giving her all the information up front. And my wife is actually calling me at this very, very second, but I'm going to call her back in a second. live podcasting. But, you know, the other things my wife was saying, and if I have to hear one more episode about how many listeners you have or this statistic or this percentage or whatever, guys, I enjoy doing stuff like that. Usually the first episode of every month, I carve out 4 or 5 minutes to talk about how many listens it got, what some of the demographics are, those kind of things. I like doing that. If you don't like it, that's fine. But I do like talking about demographics and such. And it was interesting. I got asked by somebody recently, how long did it take you to get to close to 3,000 listeners every month? And I had told them that it's interesting because it took 7 or 8 months to get to 600. And then it took another 3 months or so, 3 or 4 months, to go from 600 to 2,700. So really pretty amazing. And I'm very, very proud of this show. And I'm very, very proud of the fact that so many people are getting value out of it. Every once in a while, I'll search on Facebook. I'll just search for the show or I'll search for my name. And people are talking about it, which I think is wonderful. I've got some tremendous interviews coming up over the next couple of months that are on the docket. So today, of course, I've got Dr. David Schechter. He is the author of Think Away Your Pain. He's also a practicing physician in Southern California, mind-body physician. So we go through the gamut. We talk about a lot of things today on the show. But coming up over the next few weeks, so you're going to hear from this gentleman, Jeremy, who actually has my all-time favorite healing story aside from my own. But my all-time favorite healing story, he wrote a great blog about it. I'm interviewing him, so that'll be on the show in a couple of weeks. In about a month, you're going to hear from Nicole Sachs. It's actually the first time in the show where I'm re-interviewing somebody or interviewing somebody again. And I'm actually in talks with another author, pretty well-known author in this mind-body space, about setting up an interview that would be scheduled to take place in about 2 weeks, which means it would probably air 5 or 6 weeks from now. So there's a lot of really exciting content and stuff that is coming up on the show. I really, really hope that you find the time to tune in. I wanted to keep this introduction short and sweet. So again, go to iTunes, go to Apple Podcasts. Please leave a review. 75% of listeners, there's some more stats for my wife. 75% of listeners are listening on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. So please do leave a review if you've got some time. And then if you are interested in some kind of a coaching program, e-course, something like that, developed by me. Again, I'm a male in my early 30s. I've had a variety of different issues, back pain, neck pain, gastrointestinal problems, stomach pain. I've spent thousands of dollars to get this kind of stuff healed. Knee pain, sciatica, you know, you name it. And I've kind of had it, elbow issues, shoulder issues. I've even had surgery. And so, being able to help people that feel like they're kind of stuck. You know, I thought that I was a former athlete. And then, once I started getting into this stuff and applying some key principles to it, I was able to get back to my sport. Now I am a weightlifter and I am the strongest that I've ever been. So, I would love to hear from you. Without further ado, here is Dr. David Schechter. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and I am here today. We've got a big treat. Dr. David Schechter from Culver City, California. How are you, Dr. Schechter?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. You know, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down for this interview. I got connected with you through Christy Weepy at the Pain Psychology Center, and it's really neat, this network I'm starting to find of all these people that are so intertwined. You start to learn how small the universe is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, so like I know that you've got a book, Think Away Your Pain. It's available on Amazon. I know that you've got a practice in Culver City. I have some actually really specific questions that I want to get to in this interview, but I want to get a background. Like, I know that you have a history or a tie-in with Dr. Sarno specifically, and I know off air we talked very briefly about it, but I guess tell the listeners what your connection was to Dr. Sarno, how you met him, and you know, kind of run through that whole story.
Yeah, I was a young 21-year-old medical student in my first year of medical school, and I was a runner and played a lot of basketball, and knee pain began to afflict me and began to get worse and worse. And I saw some of the typical practitioners, like the student health doctor. They even referred me to an orthopedic surgeon who was affiliated at that time with the New York Yankees. And nobody could really give me a clear understanding of why my pain was there and how to get rid of it. You know, they gave me certain exercises to do and things. And so getting a little frustrated by this and starting to research in the library and trying to understand what was going on with me, and some of you may be able to relate to that if you're dealing with chronic pain, I walked into the office of Dr. John Sarno, who had lectured to us in anatomy, and I knew that he was a physical medicine rehabilitation doctor. That was all he was known for at that time. He was not yet the guru of mind-body medicine, as he later became. And so I walked into his office expecting to get referred for maybe some high-tech physical therapy or something, and I briefly told him what was going on, and he looked up from his papers and asked me two or three questions, and he said, well, I don't know if you'll accept this, but 95% of chronic pain is psychosomatic. And so that's sort of like was being hit with a cold blast of air. It wasn't what you were expecting to hear.
Right.
And he said, but you know, don't worry, there's a seminar I give Monday nights to my patients. You can come and check it out, and if you think this might apply, I'd be glad to see you in the office and try to make a firmer diagnosis of this condition I call TMS. And so I decided what I have to lose. I went to the seminar the following Monday night, and there were a bunch of well-dressed Upper East Side and Upper West Side people, and lowly me, the 21-year-old medical student with some corduroy pants. And you know, he started to present in the slide format, obviously years before PowerPoint was invented, and presented these slides that presented it and conveyed a very convincing case that emotions and the mind might be the key factor in pain, not your back or your knee or whatever it is, a particular organ that was hurt, especially if that had been appropriately ruled out, as mine had been with some testing. And so by the end of the evening, I was very intrigued, very connected to what he had to say, went home and sat down on my bed in my tiny little apartment in Manhattan, and I felt like a weight was lifting off of my shoulders. It was a very dramatic kind of evening because suddenly there seemed to be an explanation, an answer, and some hope. And so at that time, he had a series of seminars, so I went to the next seminar, and then eventually he examined me in the office and looked for the tender points that he associates with TMS. And basically, this led to my starting to play basketball within a week or two, my starting to walk faster and then run, and really a return to all my activities that I had been missing so much as a stressed out first-year medical student. So it was a profound experience in my life to be cured by a few lectures and a brief discussion with a doctor. And that was the beginning. When I presented this to other medical students I knew, they thought it was crazy. They thought it didn't make any sense to them. It didn't fit with their worldview. And the few physicians I mentioned it to also were quite skeptical of this approach. The following summer, I was able to get a research grant, a small grant, and I was able to spend the summer in Dr. Sarno's office calling patients who he had treated, about 175 of them, and I began to hear the same stories over and over again. I documented data from that, which later was used in his first book, Mind Over Back Pain, and I think his second book, Healing Back Pain. And this data convinced me even further that it wasn't just me that this approach could work for, but that there were large numbers of people out there that he had helped with this very unusual treatment approach for pain. And in addition to doing the research, I was also able to see patients with him. So I was kind of his first student slash devotee in the medical field. That's how it started.
You know, I've interviewed a few people now on this show that were seen by. So you're the fourth or the fifth person that I've interviewed that's actually been seen and treated by him. And one thing that I thought was really interesting. So Jeanette Barber from the Rosie O'Donnell Show was on a few weeks ago, and she had told me that when she went and saw him, it was, you know, it was a completely different experience than any of the 20 doctors or whatever it was that she had seen prior to that. And I think that she said out of pocket, she had spent about $20,000 on care and then went and saw Sarno. And she said that at the time he was charging $575 to see him, but that basically you could see him as many times as you want. And the goal was that you were going to be healed, and that she went to the lectures. And I think it was within a week, she was completely cured, like pretty amazing. So I guess, you know, describe to me where, because I've seen a ton of doctors for my own issues. I saw the 25th doctor was the one that kind of turned me in a completely different direction. I guess, what do you now being a doctor yourself and obviously interacting with other MDs, like what really set Sarno apart? How is he different in how he evaluates patients versus, you know, a typical MD that a lot of us listening to this are probably seeing? Or have
that's a, you know, that's a very good question. And to answer it in more detail, I'll flip it forward to what he taught me and to what I'm doing differently 25 years later. And that is that I see many of these patients who've seen 10 and 15 and 20 and in some cases 50 physicians prior to seeing me. So what is it that I'm doing differently? Well, the most important thing is I'm asking these people about their emotions. I'm asking these people about their childhood. I'm asking my patients about things that are bothering them. And none of the 50 physicians typically have delved into any of these subjects whatsoever. So the patients, when they're asked these questions, it's really, oh, this is different. This is the first time anyone has gotten into this. But that's really the key here, because what Sarno taught me was that you have to connect the person's stress or their emotional life or their personality, et cetera, to the pain in order to make the pain go away. And everyone else in the medical field is very well trained to just ask about the pain and to discuss what treatments have been tried and to suggest their next magic bullet, whether that be an injection or a medication or a surgery. But no one seems to be really well trained to ask the questions about what's going on in your life. What are you stressed about? What kind of issues are you dealing with in your family, financially, your job, your boss? And that was what I derived from my experience as a student under Dr. Sarno and as a patient, and what I've been able to bring forward into my work over the last 25 plus years. So that's really the difference. That's what we do differently, and that's how we get a different result, because I would not claim to be smarter than these other 50 physicians that patients have seen, but what I would claim to is to be looking at things with a different perspective, a wider perspective. It's as if everyone else has tunnel vision looking down a very narrow corridor, and I'm opening up that vision to a wide-angle lens view, and I'm able to see different things.
What since Sarno's theory is so... it's so driven by unconscious emotions, repressed emotions, things like that. Do you find it difficult when, if somebody comes into your office and they've seen a ton of different doctors and they're, you know, they might, even with you, might just be expecting the same thing. Oh, you know, take this pill or let's do this injection or whatever it is. Let's say that they, you know, on your website, it very clearly says that, you know, that's not your style, right? That yeah. You know, mind body is one third of the entire website. And so, but if somebody does come into your office and you ask them about their life or, you know, different things that are going on in their emotions or their childhoods and things like that. I mean, since it tends to be repressed emotions, do you find that in an office visit like that, like, can people uncover, like, can they make that? Because I know for me, I couldn't make that connection immediately.
Well, there's two groups of people who see me with chronic pain. One is a group that is aware of what I do, as you mentioned, from via the website or my book or through referrals, et cetera. So that group of people who's already aware that I do this is not surprised that I delve into this. And in the course of my perhaps 45-minute consultation with them, it's not unusual for us to be able to unearth some of the basic issues that they're dealing with. I wouldn't say that we can do in-depth psychotherapy in that 45-minute session and cover all the other things I have to cover as a physician, including an examination, review of MRIs, etc. And I don't claim to be a psychotherapist. But we can often get at least started on figuring out what some of the key issues are that they need to deal with. And they can take those forward into the home educational program, the journaling, or the psychotherapy referral, and any or all of which might be part of my prescription for them after they leave the office. In terms of the subpopulation of people who come to my office not being aware of my interest in this area, or perhaps thinking that they don't fit into that interest and that they should just be treated in a more conventional way, if I do feel that they would benefit more from a mind-body approach than a more conventional approach, then they're sometimes surprised, and they're sometimes a little hesitant, but they're also, if you do it gently, they're also sometimes interested and intrigued that a physician would look at different aspects of their life than just where the pain is or whether it's tingling versus numbness or whether it gets better with Advil or Aleve. So I think there is a level of interest, but occasionally there are people who withdraw a little bit, and they're not quite sure if this is a direction they want to head.
Now, you said earlier that Sarno mentioned to you, you know, what if I told you that 95% of these ailments or pain issues or whatnot are psychosomatic? I mean, does that align with what you've seen in practice in the last 20 or so years, that of the people that come in with, you know, knee pain or back pain or neck pain or a variety of different things, that it seems to be about 95%, or do you think that was maybe too generous?
I think it depends on the subgroup. Again, what I've learned is that there's a difference between acute pain and chronic pain. Chronic pain is typically defined as, you know, 3 to 6 months or more of pain. So let's just say a year or more. So if you take people with a year or more of chronic pain who've been treated in the conventional system with the typical things, medications, physical therapy, maybe they've gone to acupuncture, maybe they've had chiropractic, maybe they've had injections. If that group, that individual has not responded to these treatments by the typically well-trained physicians that they're seeing in my area or other areas, because I see people from out of town and all that as well, I would actually say at that point that they probably have a 95% chance of having TMS when they come in the door.
Wow.
So now you have to remember that some of the people who were treated with those conventional or alternative approaches are going to get better. They're never going to show up in my office. You know, they did acupuncture for a few weeks. They felt better. They did physical therapy for 6 weeks. The problem improved. So they don't end up in the office. We're talking about a group of people who, like myself, when I saw Sarno 30 years ago, have tried conventional treatment and not improved and have unimpressive, or you could say negative, which is the word in medicine for unimpressive, imaging, right? We say negative when it means nothing and positive when something shows up,
right,
compared to the opposite. So, yes, I would say that in that group of people, and I'll tell you another thing, which is if I can find TMS in a person with chronic pain, I feel like that person has the absolute best chance of improving compared to anything else they might do in the medical system. Because my data, published data, other doctors' published data, Sarno's published data, some of which I was involved with collecting, show that if a diagnosis of TMS is made for you in the office of a physician who knows how to treat TMS and perhaps brings a collaborative team together, because there's certainly a role for psychotherapy, et cetera, that you probably have a 75 to 80% chance or higher of getting better or of being cured. And so there's nothing else in chronic pain that offers you a 75 to 80% chance or better of being cured. In fact, the traditional pain psychologists, these would be people who are not from the group that you mentioned earlier, but the more traditionally trained pain psychologists, they're always looking to shave 10 or 15% of the pain off the top. And they consider that a great accomplishment if they're able to help somebody manage a chronic pain condition where it reduces it by 10 or 15%. My goal is to reduce it 100%, to eliminate it. And if for some reason we only get to 85 or 90% improvement, you know, I don't consider that a failure, but, it's a tremendous improvement in a person's quality of life. But I consider 10 or 15% improvement to be almost statistical variation. It doesn't really have great significance to me. So it's interesting how when you start with the attitude that Dr. Sarno taught me, which is to seek a complete healing and cure of the problem, that you have a much higher likelihood of achieving a very good or excellent or complete result.
It makes me think of I'm a part of a couple Facebook communities on TMS and the mind-body syndrome, and there's probably between the three of them that I'm in, there's probably, I don't know, 5,000, 6,000 different people. And I feel like one thing I see a lot is people saying that they live in a part of the country, a part of the world where there's not a TMS physician. And of course, you know, some people have the means to where they could fly out to see you or see Dr. Schubiner or see, you know, a variety of different people across the United States and across the world. But if they don't have those means, I guess what, you know, how can they be? It's tough to say definitive, right? If you can't evaluate them, then there's no real way to say that it's definitive. But if there's somebody that has that 3 to 6 months or more of chronic pain and they have seen doctors and they've done blood tests and they've ruled out the major ones, right? The cancer and the tumors and things like that. Like, what, I guess, can be some reassurance for them that this is the right path for you?
Yeah, well, that's one of the challenges in the field, because, you know, where it started out with Dr. Sarno being the only physician diagnosing TMS, and then I was pretty much the second, and then there was gradually a third and a fourth and a fifth. When we had a conference about 8 or 9 years ago, I remember calling Dr. Sarno in that conference, and he said to me, yeah, I remember the days where we could have had this conference in a closet. It would have been, and there would have been plenty of room, you know, for the people. But at this point, you know, a whole ballroom was filled with both physicians. Maybe there were 20 plus physicians there around the country, and there were probably another 40 or 50 psychotherapists. So the numbers have increased, but there's clearly not one in every large city or even every, and certainly not every community in the U.S., and there's a smaller number abroad. So what would a patient do? What would a person do with pain, chronic pain, or other unexplained symptoms, who is far from the ability to make a clear diagnosis. Because I think that that's very important, and I think that most of the physicians and many of the psychotherapists would agree that the ideal thing is to first be diagnosed by a TMS physician, because you get that clarity and that sense of confidence that you can then use for whatever it is you're doing after that. So I think that the steps are that a person should find a local physician who is conservatively based. So I generally would say stay away from a surgeon if you can. So a neurologist or a physical medicine rehab doctor or a well-trained family medicine sports medicine doctor might be better choices for you, because even if they have no idea at all what TMS is, their approach tends not to be surgical. So you're kind of looking to go to them and say, well, what do you find here? And they would typically do examinations, and they might do imaging. Imaging is very commonly done, whether it be X-ray, MRI. And so you're looking for someone who might give you that opening and say, well, you know, this can be treated conservatively, or I see no reason why you'd ever need to have surgery, or many people improve with this condition. That would give that patient the opening, if they are interested in exploring it on more of an educational level. So the educational level would be to read some of the books on the subject, look for some of the podcasts on the subject. You know, on my website, which I'm sure you'll mention later, but I'll mention it now, mindbodymedicine.com. On the first page, I've got links to a number of podcasts, radio interviews, TV interviews, PBS interviews, and things that I've done. And that's all free, and people can access that information. And so the idea of self-study, once you've had the parameters of your condition defined by a local physician not aware of TMS, that would perhaps be the next stage, is the self-study stage of learning more about this condition and how to treat it. And, you know, in my book that you mentioned, Think Away Your Pain, we have very detailed descriptions of how does a physician go about diagnosing it. And I wrote that chapter both for the hope that physicians will read it and want to begin diagnosing TMS, and also for the fact that patients who maybe don't have a physician available would have a clearer picture of what the diagnostic process is. And then there's, you know, then there's psychotherapists who are, their ability to communicate with patients might be a little bit broader in terms of licensing or malpractice issues or whatever. So there's psychotherapists in Los Angeles who work with people around the country and around the world by, you know, teleconference, by Skype or telephone call. And so there are some resources that a patient in almost any area can access. As a physician, and I can't speak for any of the other physicians, but in the United States, I feel like I need to have a patient one face-to-face visit in my office in Los Angeles in order to both make the diagnosis in the most effective way, and also because of licensure, which is medical licensure is state by state, and malpractice insurance is state by state. And so that limits me a little bit. When people are in other countries, we sometimes have ability to make some exceptions on that.
Yeah.
But again, the best thing is face-to-face, because you can't do the full thing as well just on the first visit on the teleconference type of Skype thing.
Talk about that's okay. So that part of your book, I'm really glad that you said that. So that part of your book about being about the diagnostic approach, and that, you know, it's designed partially hoping that physicians will read it so that they can better understand and maybe how to evaluate it. But also people that may be sitting on their couch in, you know, Birmingham, Manchester, something like that, like a different part of the world. Right. What are some of the things that you recommend in that part of your book that people do for diagnostic if they're going to try and self-diagnose?
In addition to what I just mentioned, which would be seeing a local physician who has ruled out some of the more serious conditions. Hold on. You still hearing me?
Yep.
In addition to seeing a local physician to rule out some of the more serious conditions, you know, the presence of tender points, and I have diagrams in my book as to where those six classical sarno tender points are located. And although it's hard to do the exam on yourself, you might be able to simulate it or have a friend or a spouse push on your back on those six spots and see how many of them you're tender in. The presence of tenderness in two or three or more of those spots is helpful, not required, but helpful in diagnosing the condition. Some simple things in my TMS questionnaire, such as improving on vacation or being better when you're away from work or distracted, is an indication that TMS may be a factor or maybe a diagnosis here in this case. So there's certain things by your history that we can do. The presence of other stress-related health issues, such as irritable bowel syndrome, teeth grinding, and tension headaches in your past or present life, can be further confirmation that you're at risk for another chronic pain condition. And the type T personality, sort of those characteristics that Dr. Sarno started to elaborate and that I put together into this type T category, which would be being hard on yourself, perfectionist, people pleaser, goodist, very responsible for others. You know, having a number of these characteristics, again, puts you at higher risk for having this diagnosis of TMS.
The tender points have always been really curious to me. Like in the diagrams that are in Sarno's in healing back pain, he mentions the upper trapezius. He mentions, when I look at it, I think of the piriformis, but he says the gluteal. And then he says lower lumbar, and I think that you say QL, right? Which are they're close.
They're very close. My picture is on page 136 of my book, Think Away Your Pain. It's definitely the upper trapezius. About 3 to 5 pounds of pressure is typically applied by the examiner. You come down to the lower back, and there's an area where if a person is fairly slim, there's a little bit of an indentation before you hit these vertical muscles, meaning running up and down, a few inches from the spine, depending on the person's anatomy. And thicker people, muscular people, heavier people, it's a little harder to find that sort of crease or division. But I'm able to, obviously, with practice with my fingers, I can find it. Again, 3 to 5 pounds of pressure. This time applied a little bit more horizontally in toward the spine from the outside in rather than straight down. And I can usually find the tender points there. And the gluteal ones are upper outer gluteal. They're definitely not piriformis because that's sort of mid buttocks. And this is upper outer. And then the additional ones that we sometimes look at are the beginning of the IT bands, which may be additional tender points, not part of the classic six, but they are part of the eight. The upper IT bands are often tender in people with TMS when pressed again with that 3 to 5 pounds of pressure. So those are the eight or six classical tender point areas. And what Sarno and I found when we discussed it over the years was that they're almost always found in women. Almost all women with this diagnosis have at least two, sometimes three or four, occasionally six of these tender points. In men, they can also be present, but there are some men who describe zero when you examine them.
Interesting.
And I just wonder if that's related. I've seen it in football players. I've seen it in other people who are very involved in rugby and stuff. So maybe these are just men that have such a high pain threshold when it comes to pressure that the amount that you're applying just doesn't even register in their brain anymore because they've done a lot of collision sports or things.
Right.
But anyway, so he said to me, you don't have to have that you don't have to have the tender points, but it's certainly helpful in the diagnostic process when you have it. And when I see somebody with all six and they're jumping off the table with 2-3 pounds of pressure on all six, I mean, that I tell them that they're typically that, you know, you're the poster child for TMS with those tender points.
One of the other things that I thought was interesting, and this is the only time where I've actually seen this talked about, but that 2020 special that he was on in 1999, he was talking about, he was asked by John Stossel, like, you know, I have real stuff on my imaging. I've got a crack in my vertebrae. I've got multiple herniated discs, that kind of thing. And Sarno talks about how there's no way that a little bulging disc or a little herniated disc could cause that kind of pain. He's like, sometimes I'll see patients with these big things on both sides of the back. And what I think he's talking about are maybe like the spinal erectors. Maybe those are enlarged or they're extra big. Like when he says big things on both sides of the back, like, you know, I can't ask him that question. So do you think that that's what, like, do you see people that have these big spinal erectors maybe on both sides of their spine and, you know, that like physical symptoms that you can look at and touch? Like, that's one thing that's kind of always confused me that he had said in the 2020 special. I guess maybe comment on that if.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the 2020 special. It's very good. It's on YouTube and it probably had millions of views already, which is fantastic. I obviously can't know what he intended to say, and I can't ask him anymore because obviously he passed away. But what I think the question you're asking, though, at a broader level is, you know, is it possible to have structural findings and still have TMS, and what does that mean? So Sarno's books tend to present a fairly black and white perspective, which is you either have TMS or you have tumor, broken bone, or infection. And that's fine when it comes to me looking at someone who's got a 3-millimeter bulging disc that maybe it's on the side where the pain is, maybe it's not, but it's not touching any nerves. It's just something, it's gray hair of the spine. It just doesn't have any significance. And I tell the patient right off the bat, that bulging disc means nothing. Ignore it. It's just, it's commonly found in the population at large, according to multiple studies. It has no significance. But what happens when somebody has a 7-millimeter disc and it's right next to the nerve and they've got some pain down that leg that corresponds to the distribution of that nerve, and yet when I examine them, they have a real TMS-prone personality, tender points, traumas in their life, etc. So I call that a mixed picture. And that is a different, you know, kind of way of looking at it than the traditional approach, but I think it's more intellectually honest, because I have a hard time saying to someone who's got this objective finding, oh, that has absolutely no significance in your pain, because I feel like it's defying science, if you will.
Right.
So I tell them, in my experience, this is where you can have TMS plus you can have a structural. This is a subgroup, so we shouldn't belabor the point too much, but maybe what you're relating to in terms of how Sarno interpreted, I'm just trying to relate to how I would interpret something like that. And so I'll tell them that you're in a subgroup of people who have a kind of this gray area pattern. It's a little bit more like a spectrum from all TMS to all structural on one end or the other, and you're kind of a little bit in between. And they'll say to me, well, can I get better? And I'll say to them, in my experience, if you deal with the TMS side of this equation, you typically get 50, 60, 70, 80, sometimes 100% better, even though you have the structural component that explains some of this. And sometimes we have to do something as radical as give them one epidural and then move on with the TMS stuff. And when I've asked Sarno about epidurals back when he was alive, he would say to me, oh yeah, it's a pretty good painkiller for a while. So he wasn't totally against an epidural as long as we understood what it was and what it did and what it didn't do. And research now shows that epidurals don't have any, quote, long-term effect on curing the back. But again, they may represent a short-term painkiller for some people who haven't responded to other things. This presents a little bit broader perspective on the mind-body process, because you know, maybe some of the people you're talking about are a little bit more doctrinaire on it has to be TMS in these cases, where I look at it in a little different way.
It makes me think of when I interviewed Dr. David Hanscom, and he said basically when he had created this DOC program or DOC protocol, which is direct your own care, that he, you know, he'd have somebody come into his office, and really it sounded like it was pretty, I mean, he would never schedule surgery sooner than 12 weeks after he saw them the first time, but he was having hundreds of people cancel back surgeries because when they went through 12 weeks of, you know, journaling and doing meditation and the different parts of his protocol, they were coming back with a drastic reduction in pain or no pain at all. So it makes me think a lot about what you're talking about.
I think that there is some very interesting aspects to his research and his clinical experience there in terms of people that he thought, based on his surgical knowledge, he thought that they required surgery. But he didn't think it was an emergency, and he wanted to put them through this program, which, if nothing else, would put them in better physical condition and psychological condition for surgery. And then when they came back for their follow-up, the interesting thing was the percentage. It wasn't 100, but the percentage of people who came back and said, you know what, I'm enough better now that I don't really need to think about getting an operation. He said, great, go on, keep doing this journaling and other stuff, and you don't need to have surgery. So I think, to me, maybe that speaks to the fact that he, in a sense, saw a gray area picture here with somebody who had TMS and structural findings, and he was still, at that point in his career as a surgeon, trying to decide, you know, whether to use his surgical skills to alleviate them of pain, but not potentially cure all of their pain, because some of it was TMS related. And as he found out, actually, maybe most of it was TMS related, because the level of pain went down dramatically when they did programmatic issues, which were basically like a TMS program.
And he talked so much about the changes in the chemistry inside your body. And it was almost as if, like, because you're activated in fight or flight and the sympathetic nervous system is, you know, revving up so high, really, like, you don't really have a chance to give yourself even a healing environment, even if there is a structural problem, if you're too wound up. Okay. So you mentioned journaling and you talked about it earlier, and you have a sibling, a companion to think away your pain that's available. It's journaling exercises. Talk to me about your journaling methodology. What do you think people need to be doing? Because I think journaling is such a vague term, and there's some people that like Nicole Sachs has written a book on journal speak, which she talks about specifically. Dr. Hanscom talks about journaling. Sarno, in his third book, talked about this idea of making the lists and then thinking critically about the lists. Talk about your methodology of journaling and you know why you think it's beneficial and what's vital that people need to be doing in the journaling in order to see good results.
Within a few years of my starting to get a lot of referrals from Dr. Sarno in the mid-90s or early to mid-90s, and this was a point after which we reconnected after not having seen that much of each other because I was on the West Coast, he was on the East Coast. And when we reconnected, he had already published his second book, I think, Healing Back Pain, which was a bestseller. He said that he had a lot of phone calls in New York for people who wanted to see a doctor in Los Angeles and California, and obviously he passed, once he realized that I was doing this work, he passed them on to me. And this led to a large number of people coming into my office kind of all at once for a possible TMS diagnosis and treatment. And one of the things that I began to utilize within the first year or two of that work was journaling, because nobody had really used it before. And I realized from some of the reading I had done and some of the experience I had that writing about your feelings was an extremely effective tool to get at some of the emotional bases for TMS / chronic pain. And when I had people write, they did better than those that didn't write. But I found that they often petered out after a week or two because it was hard for them to figure out what to write. So I wrote a book called The Mind-Body Workbook in 1999, which was the first treatment-focused TMS book, because prior to that, it had always been Sarno's more theory focused books. And you know, the one criticism of some of his books is it doesn't focus as much on treatment as it does on theory. So the workbook is a 30-day guided journal, and it gives people questions to try to provoke thought and feeling that they can then write directly into the journal. And if it goes beyond the amount of room that they have in the journal, they can extend it onto a blank notebook. So I encourage people to write every day if they can, or at least 5 or 6 days a week, perhaps 10 to 15 minutes. And there's some people 5 minutes is enough, and there's some people 20 minutes doesn't feel like enough. But I tell them about 10 to 15 minutes in the evening. Usually it's better in the evening after the whole day than it is in the morning. But for some people, they have to do it the other way around because of their lifestyle. And it's basically free flowing. There might be a topic in my workbook, but from there, you have to just kind of let it flow. And I think that we're able to access deeper feelings, emotions, maybe the unconscious when we start writing in a non-directed way, meaning we're not worried about grammar, we're not worried about spelling, we're not worried about punctuation. We're just trying to let it out. And you know, there's various techniques of journaling that myself and other physicians have used over the last 20 years since I wrote the Mind-Body Workbook. And you know, Dr. Hanscom uses a little bit of what he calls negative journaling, and that would be just, you know, get as dark as you can about your feelings. Write, take a piece of paper and just get dark for 5 or 10 minutes, really upset, angry stuff, and then rip it up afterwards. Tear it up, burn it in the fire. And so that's one method of journaling. The kind of method that I use in the workbook is expressive journaling. You're expressing your feelings, but you're also getting a chance to look back at it potentially a week or 10 days later. And that can provide additional insight because you realized how far you've come in your writing over that time. And it's not unusual for patients to finish the 30 days and say, okay, what do I do next? And I usually say to them, just get a blank notebook and try to use some of the themes that have come out from your writing the first 30 days and elaborate upon them. Some of them like to buy it. A second workbook. I've been working for some time on trying to do another mind-body workbook, so there'll be another 30 days on that. Hopefully one of these days I'll finish it. But the, you know, the basic thing is get there, just write. And it's extremely effective. There's a lot of research in the non-TMS community about the effects of writing, even on conditions such as asthma, rheumatoid arthritis, on reducing inflammation of all things in these conditions, by just writing about your feelings, in contrast to a control group that just wrote about their day-to-day events. So it's a powerful tool. And a patient yesterday in the office said to me, wouldn't it be great if physicians were recommending this like you do? I find it very helpful, they said. And I said to them, it would be hugely not only effective, but cost-effective. Imagine if instead of prescribing expensive medications and treatments, if doctors were saying to people, go to Staples and buy a $4 blank notebook and write about your feelings for a month, or buy the Mind-Body Workbook to do the same. I mean, it would be an incredibly cost-effective thing in healthcare as well as clinically effective. So hopefully it will spread out, I know Nicole has focused on that in her book as well, and David Hanscom's used writing as well. So it's become more popular. When I showed it to Sarno years ago, he said, oh, it's kind of interesting. You have a more structured approach than I do. I give people a little bit more open-ended. But, you know, it works for my patients to have that structure because sometimes you need to have something that you know, okay, I better get day 12 done because I'm seeing Dr. Schechter again in a couple of weeks and he's going to ask me how many days I've done in the workbook and, you know, I better kind of get through it. So it does give them, it's kind of a structured day-by-day thing to do.
So one big thing that caught my eye when I was on your website, when I was on SchechterMD.com, is that, okay, so it says that you're a sports, you know, family medicine, but sports medicine. And the people that listen to this podcast regularly, they know my story. Like basically, when I really sat down and thought about it, I've had symptoms, mind-body symptoms for 20-ish years, maybe 22 years, something like that. But I had gone to 25 different medical professionals, and on the 25th one or 24th one, there was a doctor, Dr. Kimberly Hanscom, or not Hanscom, Dr. Kimberly Harmon, who's at the University of Washington, and she is the head physician for the University of Washington Huskies football team. And, you know, she's a doctor, but she also does surgeries. And I had just heard really good things about her. And I went to go see her about doing like hydrodissection because I had positive EMG results that showed some nerve problems in the brachial plexus. And one of the diagnoses I kept getting was thoracic outlet syndrome. And but the thing is, like my symptoms moved around a lot, and I at this point I hadn't read Dr. Sarno's book. I was going, you know, seeking to her to find basically another treatment. What's this miracle treatment? And it's almost like a dream now at this point because she evaluates my imaging, she does a physical evaluation, she has me checks my shoulder mobility, my neck mobility, and you know, reflexes, things like that. And then she just says, what's going on in your life? And it was so like,
great.
It was so great. Different, right? And I had emailed her months later after I read Sarno's book and just said, look, like, you know, I want to be able to thank you someday. She's doing a research sabbatical now. But I'd love to go and see her again. But that it was so different from what I had ever seen. But she started to, you know, I compete in Olympic style weightlifting, and I'm, you know, I have that competitive mindset. I'm an athlete. And she had referred me out to a sports psychologist, and I didn't end up working with him long term, but he was talking to me about how when he works with like collegiate athletes, as an example, that if they put a ton of pressure on themselves and they get these big manifestations of physical symptoms. And so, you know, you work with athletes, whether it's a kid that likes to play soccer or it's somebody that's at UCLA playing basketball. Like, I imagine that you see athletes from all different realms. Like, you know, do you see TMS in some athletes that you see? And what is it about the mindset in some of these people? Maybe they didn't have a traumatic childhood, but, you know, we know that athletes want to get better all the time. And so I guess maybe spend a little bit of time talking about where sports medicine and TMS intersect in your experience.
Well, that's a new question. I don't think I've been asked that question before, but I'm glad you asked it because I actually have two current collegiate athletes in my practice that I'm treating for TMS. And they bring up some of the issues you mentioned. I mean, one of the individuals made I'm going to keep it vague enough, obviously, so it's completely confidential. But one of the athletes made such tremendous progress over 1 year in his sport, which was one of the CGS sports. Do you know what that is? Centimeters, grams, and seconds.
I don't.
Yeah, CGS they call it. Anyway, so in other words, it wasn't basketball or football. It wasn't a team sport. It was CGS sport.
Sure.
So he was making such tremendous advance over a course of a year that he was being told by coaches, oh, you could make the Olympic team in a couple of years and you're doing fantastically, et cetera. And then, lo and behold, pain came on that nobody could define, explain, you know, continue to hurt, wasn't able to train. And so as I worked with him, and I did refer him to a very good psychotherapist in the area as well, as we worked with him, we realized that, you know, he was excited about the fact that he had improved so much in the sport, but it honestly wasn't his favorite sport. And he wasn't that excited about taking that sport further. It was just more the idea of, hey, you've just been handed a lottery ticket. Let's see if we can, you know, get the jackpot, so to speak. So he's just really decided over the last, I think, 6 weeks that he wants to just do other sports that he likes to do. And even if he can't do it at Division I level or whatever, that's what he wants to do, whether it's intramural, whether it's club. there's another sport he likes, he really loves, and he's got other professional goals as well. So he suddenly, the pain is really dramatically reduced, but it's not like he wants to go back to that sport. So that's one example where the dissatisfaction with the sport was what led to the pain. And I've also seen that in gymnasts. I've seen that in a number of gymnasts because, you know, gymnasts tend to be girls and boys, but let's pick the girls. They start at, you know, age 5, age 4. They're tremendously flexible. By age 10, they're really progressing dramatically. But let's say you're 11 or 12 and you want to do something else. Well, you've put all these years, your parents have put all this time, all this money into gymnastics, and you're getting to a point where you're maybe approaching a national level for your age group. Maybe you just want to do something else, and it's kind of, there's some conflict there. How do you get out of it? You get injured, i.e. you get pain. So if you're complaining of shoulder pain and they can't find anything, they still can't, you know, they can't make you compete anymore. They can't make you practice anymore. So sometimes it's dissatisfaction with the sport or with the lifestyle or with the pressure. The other individual, however, is someone who will do fine and likes his sport, and it's more a matter of just a personality, a really, really type T personality, someone who's just really hard on themselves and kind of feels he let his team down a little bit last year because he had a bad streak where he didn't play very well. And, you know, obviously in adjusting to school and everything, college athletes especially have a lot of issues in that regard because they're adjusting to getting through the more difficult schooling than high school while at the same time trying to compete at a high level in sports, which takes up a huge number of hours, often 4 hours a day out of your life. Mm-hmm. And so, but that person's going to do well, and he's already started to improve. And I think for him, it was more just an awareness of how hard he was being on himself and some of where that derives from. But I think that person is going to end up, you know, continuing and be able to practice and be able to play and all of that. So there's a different story. Everybody's got a little bit of a different story. You know, I've seen that in competitive violinists. I mean, it's a little bit similar to competitive athlete because, you know, they have to practice 6 hours a day and it's physical activity. You have to repeat over and over again. And I've seen situations where people just have to sort out for themselves that they really want to, you know, compete at the highest level or perform at the highest level, or are there other issues in their life that need to get some balance, you know, whether it's relationships or family issues or other things, before they can achieve their highest goals. And sometimes people need a short sabbatical from the sport or the musical competition or musical performance in order to kind of get that perspective again on why they love the thing in the first place to do it.
I think athletes are like, I feel like if there's a group of prototype, like type T people, I feel like athletes in a lot of way can be placed in that. And I won't blame you if you can't or won't comment on these three people. But when I think of like athletes that a lot of people have heard of in the United States, that to me, like me sitting back and going through everything I've been through in the last couple of years, I see like Tiger Woods, Steve Kerr, and Andrew Luck are like three guys that, or three people that I look at and I say, like, Tiger Woods had so many of these back surgeries, but he also had all this stuff going on with his wife, and he's had, you know, golf is like the ultimate perfectionist sport, I feel like. And Andrew Luck had shoulder issues for 2 or 3 years. He was the number one pick coming out of college, and the other quarterbacks taken behind him may have had a little bit more success the first couple of years. I see it there. Steve Kerr, great basketball player, coaches the Golden State Warriors. That's a high pressure, you know, boiler room type of job, especially now. Like, so I don't know. It's easy for me to see now, and I know a lot of people like doing competitive CrossFit and competitive weightlifting, and I see ailments and, you know, sitting back, armchair quarterback. Like I see it, but I think it's so cool that you work with athletes, especially with my connection of Dr. Harmon saying what's going on in your life. And even though I said, like, I have these images, Dr. Harmon, and she said, I don't care what they say, that it doesn't line up with your pain at all. Yeah. Like, these brachial plexus, you know, this problem to the, I think it was the long thoracic nerve was one, and then the dorsal scapular nerve was another, and the she just said it didn't make any sense. So
she sounds like a very good doctor, that's good that you're seeing her.
Well, she doesn't do primary care, which is the only bummer, because I was wishing that she would, but at this point in time she does not. Okay, so something that got me thinking, and I talked about this on a recent podcast too, but when Dr. Hanscom was talking about, and I mentioned earlier, the change in the body's chemistry when you're in this state, and I started thinking about like food intolerances, allergies, asthma, things like that. I guess, you know, what's your opinion on maybe the connection to those? Because, like, for me, when I think about when I had allergies and asthma develop, it was like overnight. I went from not having any sort of issues. I didn't even use an inhaler. I never was sneezing. I got in a high-pressure sales job, and within a few months, like, boom, like, suddenly I started to have overnight, like I said. So now looking back, to me, I feel like there's a correlation. You know, in your experience, do you find a correlation between like asthma, allergies, food intolerances, and TMS?
Yeah, Sarno described that years ago. He definitely thought that allergies were related to TMS and asthma. Food intolerances, I don't think we really talked about much in those days. In my own experience, those have been more difficult to treat by the TMS method. You sort of see examples where people appear to have emotional triggers. I would say I would kind of put asthma in that category where I probably had some success with a combined approach. I think you have to use some of the inhalers and the other treatments so you don't get into any breathing trouble. But I think that you with TMS work, with journaling, with stress management, I think that you can reduce the frequency and the severity of your asthma attacks substantially. And you still have to have those medical backups because, you know, it can become quite serious if it's not treated. As far as allergies, obviously there's seasonal allergies, there's food allergies, there's lots of different type of allergies, there's environmental allergies. There's a subgroup of people who come in with, I've not seen a number of these, who come in with this chemical intolerance, you know, they call it, and they can't be exposed to anything, new car smell, perfumes, etc. That group I've had some very interesting successes with because that group, really nobody has defined exactly what this multiple chemical sensitivity condition is. And it really hasn't found any scientific pathology to explain it. So that group I've had some success with where they're just so wrapped up in the idea that they're allergic to everything that kind of perpetuates the problem. And when you get them to stop wrapping up in that and give it a new name and give it a new focus, that they get better dramatically. So I think there's hope in all of these areas, some of them could fall into that sort of gray area where there's a combination of some perhaps genetic or biological predisposition to allergies or asthma, but stress and emotions can clearly play a role in making it more severe or more frequent.
Absolutely. Dr. Schechter, this has been awesome. I want to spend the last couple of minutes kind of talking about some of the different resources. So mindbodymedicine.com, there's Schechter MD. You're in Culver City. So if you listen to this in Southern California, I guess anywhere on the West Coast, I'm up in Seattle and I'm originally from Northern California, but I've got a soft spot for the South too. So you've got a couple of books on Amazon. So there's Think Away Your Pain, and then there's the companion to it, which is the Mind Body Workbook. And I know, like, so I'm a big Kindle fan. Like, that's usually what I'll do because I'm one of those guys that, like, I order something on Amazon and 2 days is not fast enough, so I need to have it in my hands. And the Mind Body Workbook, it mentions on mindbodymedicine.com that you can buy it from Kindle, and here's how you do it. Like, it looks like it's ideal to buy. To buy the workbook, but if you bought the workbook via Kindle, like, is it fine? Are people missing out on something if they wanted to get started? If they listen to this and they want to get started right away?
Yeah, the ideal format of the workbook, I created a spiral bound book so that it would lay flat on the table and you could turn from page to page and write more easily the answers to the questions. So it's not a typical bound book; it's a spiral bound book. That's to me the ideal format to be journaling in, to be writing in. There are people, for example, in other countries that don't want to pay the extra postage or whatever from Amazon to get the workbook shipped to them. So they'll order the Kindle version and they'll just buy a $2 notebook and they'll read the questions in the Kindle version and they'll write them out. So that brings up the issue of, like, how effective is it to type the answers? First of all, it's kind of hard to type in most Kindle formats. It's kind of hard to really give a full answer. Some of the newer versions you can write or type into it. But handwriting seems to be the most effective way to respond to these questions. Typing is the second, or perhaps speaking into a recording device is the second. And then the least effective is just to read the question and think the answer. So there actually is, there's a value neurologically to actually writing the answers out. So where possible, take the extra 2 days. You can always start reading Think Away Your Pain immediately from either the Audible book or the Kindle book. But for Mind Body Workbook, ideally, get the workbook so you can actually write in it. But if you don't, if you're really a Kindle fanatic like yourself, then just get the ebook and write the answers on separate pieces of paper or on your computer or on a notebook that you purchased for that purpose.
Did you do the narration for the Audible?
I did, because I did not feel that anyone else could really convey the subject matter effectively, you know, a typical narrator.
Yeah.
And I also have a son who's kind of into sound engineering, so he stuck me in his closet with a really nice microphone and a lot of padding and stuff, and we spent quite a few hours recording that, and he, you know, spruced it up a little bit.
Yeah, I bought the Audible of Healing Back Pain, which Sarno did, which I thought was amazing. And then I also bought it for the Mind Body Prescription, which somebody else did. And I just felt I just didn't feel like it had the same, you know, the same cachet.
When it comes to a scientific topic, it's hard for a narrator that doesn't have a big science background, health background, medicine background, to really convey these concepts and even pronounce the words clearly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I felt like I should do it. And I'd also done some other recorded materials because I created a Mind-Body audio program many years ago, which has been on Amazon as CDs for many years, and now is going to be available on download as well.
I did
that years ago. Also did a DVD, which is the Mind-Body Patient Panel, where I interviewed patients who had gone through treatment and tried to analyze what helped them to get better and that kind of thing. So I had done some stuff already, and so I felt comfortable with the speaking role. But I'll tell you, it's hard reading chapters. You know, it's different than just speaking or answering questions. And so I started with the shorter chapters in my book and then worked to the longer chapters. And I got better as I went along the book. But people who listen to it will not hear that distinction because unless you start with the shortest chapters in the book, you won't know that those are the ones I recorded first. So there might be a little bit of a, oh, now he's a little tired today. He seems better today. I don't know.
I don't know if you'll notice
the difference.
That's something I've always wondered about people that read their own, or even people that are reading somebody else's book for narration for the purpose of Audibles. Like when I read a bedtime story to my 4-year-old and you know, I can read, but sometimes like late at night or something like that, like I'll, you know, I mess up some words and then I re-say them or something. Like, are you not allowed to make mistakes when you record the Audible, or is it just
a
lot of it?
You really can't make mistakes. What you do is if you make a mistake and you've already read quite a bit, you just say pause, and then my engineer, who was my son, pauses it, and he just rolls back the tape, as it will, the digital tape, to the point at which I was speaking coherently, stops it there, and then I started exactly the word that I'm supposed to start at, and he allows just the right amount of time to do that. But you try not to do that very often. You really try to be perfect with it, which is hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard to read your own book. I've also had read the book, you know, many, many times before that. So you kind of have read it so many times, it's a little hard sometimes to read it fresh. And you want to have inflection, right? You don't want to have a flat, monotone kind of voice. You want to be not a theatrical performer, but you want to create an interest in terms of how you're presenting it. So it was an interesting challenge, and I think I did a decent job. So those of you who have Audible accounts and decide to download and listen to it, you can let me know, but I think it was okay.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Cool. Well, thanks again so much for your time, Dr. Schechter. I think this was great. I really think what you're doing is amazing, and I'm glad that you're our West Coast guy. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
That's how I see it.
I enjoyed talking with you and look forward perhaps sometime in the future to doing it again.
Yeah. Thanks, Dr. Schechter.